It's time to talk about the outdoors in South Alabama. Hunting, fishing, and getting outside along the Great Gulf Coast. It's time to take it outside with FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. With reports, stories, how-to information, and Dr. Bill's Marine Forecast. Here's Sean Sullivan and Mike Ward.
And away we go, FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Good to see you, Captain Mike.
Good to see you, Captain Sean.
And you know what? Talking about this week's show is I had already planned this before I looked at the Marine Forecast.
Yeah.
So any of us that thought maybe you'd be chasing some amberjack or triggers this weekend, maybe checking out your snapper spots, or even getting out and fishing trout in the open water or bass in the Delta, is probably going to be a little tougher of a weekend. So our guest on this week's show is the flip side of that, places where you can find some protected water.
Yes.
Yeah, so we're going to do that and have that conversation. Reminder, too, always looking for your interaction and your pictures, all that good stuff on our Facebook page, FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors on Facebook. So, yeah, let me introduce our guest this week from Southeastern Pond Management. Norman Latona is joining us and lots to talk about. And good to get you on the show. Glad you're here.
Hey, great to be here, guys. Appreciate you. Reaching out. Look forward to visiting with you guys.
Okay, so let's do this, Norman. If somebody, you're at a dinner party or whatever, you know, you get hauled to the dinner party and they're like, oh, what do you do? What do you do? When they ask you, Norman, what do you do for a living? What do you tell them?
That's a good question, actually. I usually say we manage lakes and ponds. I have a pond management business, and most of them say pawn, like a pawn shop.
Yeah.
And they say, pine, like pine trees, and I say no, pond, P-O-N-D, like fishing pond. And but yeah, it's a good conversation starter, that's for sure. So but that's really what we do. We've been in business a little over 30 years now, actually going on 32 years.
Wow.
And we started right out of school in Auburn, and still have an office, still have a physical presence there in Auburn. And you know, we take care of fishing lakes and ponds. I mean, that's what we do.
Now, when you decide that 32 years ago, I mean, right now it's a no-brainer looking at what y'all do with your company. But 32 years ago, was there – I mean, it used to be, I remember, like, people say, oh, well, the state will stock you some fish and you let them go or something like that. And
yeah,
got,
that's
what, like,
right.
32 years ago, like the levels y'all are at and the way y'all manage now, was there demand for that back then? Did y'all start with a full suite of options, or what did y'all do in year one?
Yeah, so there were a couple of outfits back in the late 80s that started up. A lot of folks around the Southeast have heard of American Sportfish Hatchery, mm-hmm. Don Smith and Barry Keller. They're dear friends of ours. And so there were a couple of outfits that were starting to dabble in catering to the recreational farm pond or you know, owner in terms of you know, management and you know, stocking and lake management options. But it was pretty new, and certainly the industry has changed tremendously in three decades, both in terms of the size and scope of what we do. You know, there's just in the realm of improved genetics, for example, for fish for stocking, and the diversity, the special diversity of what we offer in the way of fish stocking. So it's changed a lot, like so many things. But back in the day, we did spend as much time explaining what pond management was as actually managing ponds. That's for sure.
I bet. Nobody knew.
Right. I'm thinking like my grandfather or something, sitting there listening to Norman tell him about what he's going to do for the lake. And he'd be like, that's where my cows drink.
Yeah.
Where... Some of those older clients, yeah, they kind of look at you with that glazed over eyes, like, what are these guys talking about managing this pond? But as you guys know, there's a lot of improvements to be made from kind of the old approach to dump some fish in there and see what happens to what we're doing nowadays and increasing growth rates and just overall production and, you know, reliably producing quality fishing on a regular basis. And that's what most of our customers are looking for.
Yeah, this is, Norman, I want to talk about going forward there. So you launch it and you start the business. It starts growing. Was it growing because more people were focusing on the given amount of water, like let's say in our area, state of Alabama? I know you work outside, but or were there that many new impoundments being made? You see what I'm saying? Were you servicing things, water that already existed, making that better? Somebody said, yeah, we can make this better. Or, hey, I just dammed up, you know, and I got a 45-acre lake now. I mean, what were the phone calls like?
Yeah, a little bit of both. I credit our genesis to a professor at Auburn named Bill Davies, just a phenomenal human being, an incredible fisheries biologist. And he took what Dr. Homer Swingle and colleagues did in the 40s and 50s down at Auburn to sort of pioneer pond management, sustainable production of fish in farm ponds. You know, that was sort of Dr. Swingle's, claim to fame. I mean, they tested all the different stocking ratios and formulas and came up with the idea of fertilizing ponds to increase yields. And really back then, pond management was about producing a sustainable yield to feed the family. You know, that's what in the 40s and 50s, being able to depend on a pond to produce a surplus annually was a big deal. It was a source of protein to feed families. Of course, nowadays, that's rarely even one of the top several objectives. Most folks don't have a whole lot of interest in eating the fish. It's purely recreational. But so that was their mindset. And Dr. Davies sort of took that from Dr. Swingle and said, you know, there's a recreational component to this. What if we don't really care how many pounds of surplus production we can create? What if we focus on quality and trophy fish production, the recreational side to it? And he actually did some research on that, adding different types of forage to these farm ponds to increase bass growth rates. And that's kind of where we came in. And Dr. Davies was a real mentor and inspired us to start our operation. And we started out with the idea we want to specialize in population dynamics. We want to cater to folks that are looking to do something above and beyond with their lake. And so that's primarily what we focused on, both new lakes and existing lakes. Folks that had lakes that were many years old just wanted to improve the fishing.
When it came to that, would you recommend draining most of those lakes to start back fresh again, or would you put something in, what is it, Roque 9 or whatever, and kill all the fish out of it and start back from there? Or would you just add fish, or what would you do? I know there's a lot of different scenarios.
But back then, what was
There are, Mike, and a little bit of both. There were certainly cases where we would go in and look at the population, the fish community, and say, you know, this is a real mess. It's terribly imbalanced. There are all sorts of undesirable competing species present. The desirable species, say the bass, are very stunted, in meaning that they're way smaller than they could be at a given age, and have probably lost a lot of their growth potential. And honestly, the best thing to do would be to renovate this thing and start over. And we still do that today on occasion. More often, though, there's something workable. That's always an option. And quite honestly, nowadays, it's an option more just – it's an opportunity, because with improved genetics, with the way we manipulate stocking ratios in new ponds now, we can very reliably produce 2 and 3 pound bass at a year old and 5 and 6 pound bass at 2 years old and upwards of 6, 7, 8 pounds at 3 years old. So, it's something really to think about, even if the existing community is salvageable, why not consider the option of starting over with fresh everything, and particularly fresh genetics? And there continue to be advances in genetics. There's some really, really cool stuff that we're not quite talking openly about yet, but there's some really neat stuff on the horizon in terms of bass genetics, and not even as much genetics as just the bass breeding, pedigree breeding of bass. I have a feeling the next decade is going to be pretty exciting when it comes to what's available, commercially available to stock into your farm pond.
Well, it's kind of like deer farming too. You know, same thing, deer farming.
Definitely.
They got the genetics and stuff, and now they grow them whatever size you want.
Well,
they got them.
And I want to get into that. We'll come back for the break. I want to talk about that more. And let me just say, as we go to the break too, that there's still, I'm still under 50, barely. And I still like that old school, the wet cupboard, you know, idea of my grandparents' time where you had that pond because, you know, you didn't know what the future, in the 1940s, 1950s, you didn't know what future held. And nice to have a bunch of available meals out there. So,
yeah.
I mean, I guess there are still some people that might get that combination of trophy and that. We'll talk about that more when we come back from the break. Our guest, Norman Latona, Southeast Pond Management, and this company... You've probably seen one of their trucks or boats coming by on the interstate before. They're all over working on ponds in our state, and we'll find out how big of a footprint they have when we come back right here on FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward. Glad to have y'all along with us. And great to talk to our guest this week from Southeastern Pond Management, man that started this, Norman Latona, and talking about kind of the infancy of this. And I got to ask Norman, I was thinking about this as we went to break. In those early days, when you were saying, okay, it's not all just about having this wet cupboard of protein stored in a pond, people were wanting to catch bigger bass and all that. Did y'all, and things were getting better on stocking, and the science was getting better, did y'all have your eyes on 22.4 pounds? I mean, were y'all thinking it's not going to be long till we beat George Perry's record?
You know, maybe, I guess, in the back of our minds, and quite, if I'm being honest, I'm really surprised that the state records and the world records haven't fallen more frequently, you know, in that 30 some odd years.
I am too, Norman.
You know, there, but what it transitioned to quickly for us. We have very few customers. Listen, we're a service operation. So we listen to what the customer says, and that's what we're going to try to do. We give them our best advice. We're not going to pass judgment on what they're looking for. If they want to catch 100 bass that are 10 inches long, and that's what they're happy doing, and they want to take the kids out and get fed every time a beetle spin hits the water, hey, that's what we're going to work to do. But so toward that end, what we were hearing more and more was not, I want to catch a 15, 16, 20-pound bass. Over and over and over, folks said, what can I do to catch 3- and 4- and 5- and 6-pound bass?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd love to catch a trophy fish. Truth is, we're going to release them anyway. What I want to do is catch a 5-pound bass every time I go fishing. And so much of what we did in terms of pioneering techniques and strategies revolved around that methodology, that objective was let's increase growth rates. Let's see if we can grow bass up to what we call quality size, that 16 to 20 inch size.
Mm-hmm.
And so really we didn't focus a whole lot on the super top end. And we do have a few customers that do some crazy things and stock really big forage, trying to get those 12-pound bass to be 15 pounds. And we see them from time to time. But moreover, folks are interested in quality production and catching quality fish. And that's the majority of our focus, to be honest.
Yeah, like a side science question. On this, genetic-wise,
the proclivity for that fish to get, you just say, okay, let's take 12 and 15 pounds, both very big fish. But is there a genetic bottleneck, or are all those bass that you could stock? Let's say you started a lake and you knew that it was the objective to get to that higher number, but passing through that quality number as well. Do they all have even potential to go from 12 to 15, or they're just, you could feed them all the same big forage and fertilize properly and everything, but some will just stop at 12? You have any kind of take on that?
Yeah, there's no question that that's the case, and we probably understand that better today than we ever have. In fact, we certainly understand that better, and genetics does play a huge role. In most cases, genetics is third in line behind age and nutrition. You know, so without age, without nutrition, you can't have, you know, genetics almost doesn't matter, at least with respect to top end, max out size. Because, you know, you can take a outstanding genetics and feed them a goldfish a month in a bathtub, and you know, that fish just is never going to grow up to true trophy size. But back to your question, yeah, there is that bottleneck. In fact, that's what we're working with a group now that is doing some really exciting stuff in identifying genetically, you know, looking at the DNA. Okay, I mean, this is complicated stuff, and actually looking at the genetic code, looking for DNA markers that indicate larger top end, larger max size, and then the ability to take that information and select it and pick that fish, much like you would do when you're trying to manipulate a breed of cattle or horses or dog breeds, okay? And it's been done in fish before, but never in the sport fish realm. It's been done that pedigree approach, selective breeding, pedigree breeding has been done in the salmon industry particularly. But the focus was on increasing production and yield for food fish.
Right.
And it's a big, you know, there's a big financial prize associated with growing salmon a lot faster and a lot bigger because there's a lot of salmon consumed all over the world. But here recently, there's a group that is dedicated themselves to doing that for largemouth bass. It's really recreational, or it's mostly recreational. It's not for the food fish market.
Right.
So I have no doubt that, and they're already seeing results, and we're already seeing results. But it's going to take a few generations to really be able to measure those results and prove the science that we believe applies.
Yeah, that's got to be. I mean, you can prove science around a growth of a 2-pound or 3-pound fish a lot more quickly than one you got to get to 12 or above. I mean, it's proven with the growth rates of the fish. I mean, once again, if y'all didn't catch it earlier, Dorman, you said y'all start off and get everything the way you want it in a pond, and you can get bass up in how big in a year, how big in 2 years and 3 years?
We have seen fish that were in their early third year of life, so they're basically 3 years of age, that were in the 8 to 9 pound range. In fact, we've seen some individuals that exceeded 9 pounds at 3 years of age. Now,
that's
not the norm,
right?
But it's also not a grand exception either. Two and a half, even up to 3 pounds a year is with current genetics and all other things considered, which is a lot. Again, you can't dump that fish in a bathtub and feed him a couple of goldfish a month and expect to get those kind of results. But we've seen that on a number of cases. Now, when we get to that 8-9 pound range, the growth rates tend to level off, and I think that's where some of that bottleneck that you referred to earlier and the real genetics start to come into play, just like humans. You know, most kids shoot up pretty quickly to 4 or 5 feet tall. You know, that getting from 5 feet to 6'8" is doesn't happen.
Yeah, that is a good point because they were all, yeah, we were all the same height. You know, Charles Barkley and I were the same height at one point.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
At one point. That's right. He kept growing.
And I stopped.
Exactly and genetics is a big part of that. I mean, right. It's been also just what it
no
is.
Doubt.
And,
no doubt.
And so with that, let's talk about some of the things y'all have learned in those years and making it. How much of your time, if you had to break it like a pie chart, how much of a time is tweaking the bass themselves? And how much of it is tweaking that feed? You talked about that bathtub, okay? We're not going to give them one goldfish. We're going to give them 25 of what every day? I mean, y'all are very specific. We're customers, y'all, and you're very specific about what we stock in there as forage.
Yeah, so it's a little bit of both. You know, when you look at a fish community, a bass population within that fish community in the pond, you know, we look at a number of measurables. But when we identify or determine that the lake is what we refer to commonly as bass crowded or predator crowded, you know, what we're really saying is there are too many bass relative to the amount of forage. And what we're really saying more specifically is there are too many bass at this size range, typically 8, 10, 12, 13 inches, relative to the amount of forage in that all-important intermediate size range, 3 to 5 inches. So most often the corrective steps involve attacking it at both ends. That's where that harvest comes in. That Sean was referring to earlier. So we can attack it from that side. Let's decrease the amount of mouths we have to feed. Let's take some fish out so that there are fewer fish chasing the forage that's in there, and then let's attack it from the other side. Let's stock fish, both species and sizes of fish that are conducive to getting to that 3, 4, 5 inches in length very rapidly. And so when we hit both of those things at the same time, that's when we see dramatic improvement in the overall condition of the bass. And, you know, that leads into, hey, you know, can you grow big fish with just bluegill? You know, is it advisable to stock threadfin shad, golden shiners, tilapia, crawfish, you know, even gizzard shad? You know, how do all these things factor in terms of, you know, growing fish, growing bass? And really what it comes down to, guys, is we need to produce forage that's suitable for those intermediate-sized bass to grow up, to jump into that next level. A 4, 5, 6, 7-inch bass, that joker's doing fine swimming around eating bluegill fry.
Right.
You know, he's eating inch-long bluegill fry, and there's usually plenty of them, and that fish is growing. And that's really what that fish needs to eat. You know, it can't eat big stuff because his mouth isn't big enough yet. But when that bass gets up to 10, 12, 13 inches in length, and it's still swimming around eating 1 and 2 inch bluegill, all of a sudden there's a significant decline in growth rate. It's just not, from a bioenergetic standpoint, it's taking more energy than it yields. And so two things happen. One, bass don't grow. You know, they quit growing. They just kind of stunt, we call it. They stay in that 11, 12, 13 inch range. And the second thing that happens that people don't think about is the fishing catch per unit of effort, angling I'm talking about, declines. And so it's sort of counterintuitive. People say, well, heck, my fish are starving to death. I ought to be able to throw a worm out
right
there, and they eat it, you know, second hits of water. But see, remember, bass are cold-blooded critters. They are all about efficiently feeding. So when there's a limited forage, they're aware instinctively, you know, I'm 12 inches long. I'm not doing myself any good chasing one-inch bluegill all around this pond. I'd be better off to hunker down in this log, in this brush pile, and wait for something to swim in front of me. So they actually become less aggressive, less active when there's limited forage.
That is counterintuitive.
Yeah. They're chasing it all over the place because it's worth it, you know.
No, that is counterintuitive because somebody would think, well, if I've, you know, if I'm bass heavy here, they should be like piranhas, right?
Mm-hmm,
they should be,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
But they don't have the energy to be piranhas, you're saying, or it's not worth the energy expenditure.
That's right. They know that they're the most efficient behavior for a bass in those conditions is let me conserve my energy. they want to be an ambush predator anyway. Let me just lock down here in this brush pile. They don't care if they weigh 5 pounds when they're 2 years old or they weigh a pound when they're 7 years old. You know, they don't have a it doesn't make a difference to them. What they're doing is trying to exist as efficiently as possible. And so when foraging conditions are poor, they tend to be less aggressive, harder to catch.
So I know this is kind of – go ahead.
No, that's okay. Go ahead.
Okay, I know this is kind of a loaded question, but, you know, there's always this question. I fish in a big old, fine, beautiful 50-acre lake, and there's always this question. Should we put shad in or should we not put shad in? I mean, you go around the world on that, put shad in or don't put shad in.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's a loaded question because every lake is different, just like everything else. But if you had to say overall, would you put shad in a lake or not put shad in a lake? And tell me the pros and cons on yes and no.
So, Mike, I mean, I would have, you know, my answer over the last 30 years has sort of changed. And today, and really for the last decade or more, I would say unequivocally yes. There
okay.
are so few cases where threadfin shad are not beneficial to the objective that we hear from lake owners. They're not even worth talking about.
Okay.
You know, the benefits of having a diverse forage base, which includes threadfin shad, to me are indisputable. You know, and interestingly, you know, back in the late 80s and through the 90s, you know, we used to really butt heads with some of the agency folks, not just in Alabama, but because traditionally that was just not done. You know, threadfin shad were considered a competitor to bluegill. Bluegill were important, and they were important to bass. And some of the population dynamics, when you really dig deep into what's going on in these lakes, the presence of threadfin shad can impact the amount of bluegill reproduction and ultimately the amount of largemouth bass, what we refer to as recruitment, meaning how many of these bass that are born every spring actually survive up to adulthood. But what we came to realize is that the fewer, the better. Is
yeah.
the truth of the matter.
Yeah.
Because we're constantly fighting this uphill battle to keep up with bass harvest.
Yes.
So if introducing threadfin shad or anything else for that matter dampens bass recruitment, that's a great thing.
And so it's a double win.
That's an aid. So, you know, I would answer your question. We never get posed that question. You know, I would answer that question by asking you a series of questions, you know, about what your objectives are, you know, what you're trying to achieve with your lake. Obviously, we need to take a look and see, you know, what the population looks like. But in almost every case, the answer to that question is it will benefit the lake and benefit the achieving your objectives by adding threadfin shad.
That's
we
why
stock them in a whole lot of lakes.
That's right. That's why I knew it was going to be a loaded question.
Coming right back. Yeah. More with Norman Latona, Southeast Pond Management, and great conversation.
Yeah.
The question, this is stuff Mike and I talking about in the boat when we're fishing. Now we got somebody who's got the answers
yes.
on the show with us. Okay, we'll be right back. As always, we have really good conversations during the news breaks as well here on FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors.
This show is not long enough for what we're trying to do I can tell you that.
So watch me do this. Let me put Norman on the spot. Hey, Norman, yeah. can we get you back on the show sometime soon?
Absolutely.
See?
I'd love to.
You do that in front of everybody. Get them in a corner on that. During the news break, we just were talking about the age of bass and not being relative to their size and them being cold-blooded. I grew up with fish tanks all in my room. I think the old story my parents said is I left to go to the University of Alabama and the power bill dropped by $110 a month back in the 1980s when I left. So I remember you'd feed them a bunch, you know, and then you'd get that growth spurt. And then if you did, it wasn't, you were saying a bell curve. So you said you pulled the otoliths out of bass that were how big and how old?
Yeah. So unfortunately, the only real way to reliably age a fish requires that you kill them. So we don't do that routinely. Obviously, we're not going to do that with larger fish, you know, so we don't get to do it a whole lot. But there's a bone in the inner ear of most fish, and it's called an otolith, and it can be dissected and pulled out and prepped and put under a dissecting scope, and you can actually read the growth ring, similar to the way you look at growth rings in a tree, and it gives you a very reliable indicator of age. And so over the years, we've done this, you know, hundreds and hundreds of times, particularly with smaller fish, just to validate what we're saying or even to provide further evidence or to illustrate to a customer, kind of what we're trying to communicate to them. And the truth is, I don't know how many times, hundreds and hundreds of times, we pulled otoliths out of 12, 13, 14-inch bass, you know, those little, what we would, as a kid, call little yearlings, you know. And they're 6, 7, 8, 9 years old.
Amazing.
The truth is they could be near the end of their life, and they just were out there trying to make a living eating stuff that was so tiny that they just didn't eat very much.
That's what you goes back to what you said earlier about the forage being equal to the amount of energy to go get that forage, right? That it'd be a net equation.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And again, fish know this instinctively. They're not going to go out there and waste a bunch of energy swimming around looking for something that's like a needle in a haystack. They're just going to hunker down and not move. And they're not going to grow very fast, but they're fine. You know, they're going to survive. They're using no more energy than they're consuming, and vice versa, and that's how they're gonna operate, and that's why these lakes that are predator crowded, bass crowded, we call it hitting them in the, like fixing a watch with a sledgehammer, you all of a sudden boom create a glut of forage, you'll see those fish change their behavior, they'll start eating and they'll start growing. Now the problem is that those bass that have been stunted for 4, 5, 6, 7 years, they've lost several years of growth potential. So they're probably never going to get up to true trophy size, but they'll pick it up and start growing, fatten up, and we see it happen all the time.
So that answered kind of my question was, okay, if we all of a sudden start pouring the feed to that fish, now it's an older fish, it's been stunted, but the feed is there, can we – how much can we expect? Probably you're saying not the same as if we started it off from day one like that, right? That they miss some kind of sweet spot for growth.
Yeah, in terms of top-end growth, certainly, because, you know, they're only going to grow so much in a given period of time in a defined time frame. So, you know, they're going to grow this much in a year. And, you know, if you've taken 4, 5, 6 years of their life and thrown it away in terms of growth, we refer to it as their growth potential. They've lost some potential. They've lost 4, 5, 6 years. You know, say a bass is going to live to 10 years of age. I mean, that's a pretty ripe old age for a bass in a pond. If he's 6 or 7 years old and still just weighs a pound, he doesn't have much time left, you know.
Right. What would he grow, possibly grow? Maybe 3 pounds maybe or something?
We've seen pretty dramatic improvement in some of these stunted lakes. When we go in and really whack the bass, remove a bunch of the surplus bass production, and then couple that with some heavy corrective restocking, introducing intermediate size forage, I mean, I think you can crank them back up and get them back to where they'll grow at a pound or better per year. We've certainly seen that.
That's pretty good.
That's what they're. I mean, that's what y'all did for us for sure. Mm-hmm. In that, and before we run out of time, getting tight here, but. Let's go to the gosh. There's you are coming back because there's like 25 other questions.
Spend all day
I've got
with you.
For you, Norman. But we talked about this also during the break. So, Florida's versus Northern's. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Norman's like, oh, great. Open this one up. Wait, can you give us like what's the elevator speech you got on the two and why you would stock one over another? Or what's better?
So. The research that really cranked up in the 80s and into the 90s kind of proved that Florida bass had a greater top end growth potential, and there were some studies even that indicated that they grew at a faster rate, particularly at a younger age, and that was really kind of enough to convince lots and lots of states, including private producers in states, to shift most of the production to Florida bass. So you saw in the 80s and 90s, even the state agencies throughout the country, not just in the South, shift to that what they call the pure Florida. The honest truth is probably very few of the bass that are stocked as pure Floridas are pure Floridas, but they're close. You know, they're you know 90%+ Florida. What we began to see, though, after a generation, once those fish began to cycle through over a decade or so, folks began to experience difficulty, as you have alluded to, in catching
fish.
Those Floridas.
Mm-hmm.
So while they probably live longer, they probably get larger, and they may even grow a little faster, particularly when they're young. Doesn't do a whole lot of good if you can't catch them. And so, particularly on artificial lures, they become increasingly difficult to catch as they get older. And so, our response to that as a fisheries community was to try to add back in that northern genetics to try to create some genetic diversity and add that aggressive gene back in to a given fish community, fish population. And so we began to do that. Well, we would stock pure northern bass because they'll readily cross with the pure Floridas. And then really as time went on into the late 90s and we got into the 2000s, the commercial growers and the research had led to what's called an intergrade, or a lot of folks refer to it as an F1, which is a bit of a misnomer. But basically, it's a cross between a northern and a Florida. So the first generation of that cross, the F1 generation, is 50% northern, 50% Florida. And so for many years, that became kind of the standard that we moved to. You get a little the best of both worlds. Mm-hmm. And we still stock a lot of intergrades, a lot of 50-50 mixes. Okay. Some of the research that and the work that's being done that I alluded to earlier is getting back to working with pure Florida bass because it's sort of established that they have a higher growth potential in terms of top end and growth rate. So if these researchers and are able to isolate that aggressiveness, that catchability gene, for lack of a better way to describe it, they can select for that in the Florida genome, in the Florida genetic profile. And so, again, you get the best of both worlds without having to sacrifice top-end growth. So I think that's the direction we're heading back to. But make no mistake, there is a difference between Floridas and Northerns. You've seen it.
Oh, yeah.
You've seen those feed-trained largemouth bass. Those are pure Northerns. And I'll tell you what, you could take a pond full of northern bass fry, and a pond right next to it full of Florida, pure Florida bass fry, and you start scattering food crumbles into the water, and in almost no time, those northern bass will be what we call feed trained. They'll start consuming that crumble, and they'll utilize it and grow like crazy. That pond right next to it, 95% of those fish will starve to death before they eat a crumble.
Florida's. All right, so we're going to pick that up when we come back from the break. Right up against the break, coming right back to wrap it up with Norman Latona from Southeast Pond Management. Yeah, and as we said during the news break, this last segment would be really short because we went so long. It's fine, though, because Norman Latona from Southeast Pond Management has already promised to come back on the show. Is that correct? Can I get a confirmation on that?
Absolutely. No, I love talking about this stuff as much as you guys do. Be happy to come back anytime.
Might have to come back two or three more times. There's a lot to cover on pond management.
Absolutely.
A lot to cover.
People want to get more information about what y'all do, what y'all can do, and, like, you know, these questions we've been talking about today. Best place to go online, what's the website?
Sean, best way to get us, go to our website, sepond.com, sepond.com.
Very good, and we will do it again really, really soon, because I've just got the Florida and northern question. You just shed more light on that information than many a front porch has produced here in a couple of years.
A lot more questions.
Do it. Norman, thank you, and we'll see you back here very, very soon. It's FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors, brought to you by McConnell Buick GMC. Big thank you to Louie and the gang there for making it happen. And coming up next, Prep Sports Report. We'll see y'all next week.